You're listening to the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Isaiah. Today, Pastor Sandy will be teaching from Isaiah chapters 4 through 6.
Ever laid under a tall, tall oak tree and just gazed upwards into the branches? You see all of the sticks and branches and limbs overlapping each other. It's tough to tell which limbs are on top and which are on the bottom. Distance between the branches is impossible to judge. It's just a maze while lying on your back looking upwards. And this is how it is with prophecy in general and with Isaiah in particular. Some of what Isaiah said was local and current. It occurred during the rise of the Assyrian Empire. Other aspects of his vision wouldn't be fulfilled for several hundred years when God sent the Babylonians to judge the southern Hebrew kingdom of Judah. Still, a vast portion of Isaiah's prophecy has yet to be fulfilled. Isaiah saw events that won't occur until a time yet future when Jesus returns to earth and establishes his kingdom. And it's these overlapping applications that make the book of Isaiah so tough for us to interpret. In fact, I'm sure Isaiah himself didn't fully understand all that he saw. Isaiah's first prophecy has this overlapping feature. Chapters 2 through 5 is a single prophecy. Chapter 2, verse 2 states that it's for the latter days. But it also spoke to the current situation. Assyrian troops were parked in the suburbs north of Jerusalem. It was time to sound the alarm. And this is the book of Isaiah. He sees locally and globally. He speaks to current and future dilemmas. And sometimes he does both in the very same passage. Reading Isaiah is like looking into the limbs of a tree. Well, chapter 4, verse 1 predicts a man shortage. And in that day, seven women shall take hold of one man. In wartime, men die in battle, and young women are left without available men to marry. There's a shortage of men, Isaiah says. Did you know this is also what's happened today on America's college campuses? In most non-engineering schools, women are far outnumber the men. This year's undergrad enrollment at UGA is 57% female. At the College of Charleston, the undergrad population is 62% women. Jake, you ought to think about going to the College of Charleston. And this, too, is due to a war. Not a literal war, but a battle of the sexes. You see, our culture's insistence on gender equality has produced a bias against boys, particularly in our schools. It's created an educational system that now favors girls and the way girls learn. Schools today are girls' world. It's easier for girls to succeed. And this change has backfired on women. For in winning the battle of the sexes, there's now a smaller pool of educated marriage partners. Here's the irony. When men are deprived the opportunity to lead, women suffer. Hope you know that. When men are deprived the opportunity to lead, women suffer. Rather than compete, the sexes need to complement one another. Isaiah says that things will be so bad, seven women will grab for one man. That's the closest I could come to seven women grabbing one man. They'll grab one man saying, "We will eat our own food and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by your name to take away our approach." Check this out. Women are so desperate to get married, they're willing to let a potential husband off the hook. They're saying, "Hey, you don't have to provide for a family. The wife will agree to birth and raise the babies and then do the housework and work a job and clothe herself and her kids." And guys, this is the social landscape that women's liberation has created in our country. Once upon a time, women were honored by men. Men sacrificed to provide for their wives so that their wife could focus on her family. Women were sheltered in a sense. They were treated as special privileges by their men. Oh, but somewhere around the mid-1970s, American feminism demanded freedom from male authority. Women's liberation fought for equal treatment for both men and women. And yet here's what feminism didn't calculate. Equal is how men treat other men. Oh, you pull your weight, I'll pull my weight. Women now have equal treatment, all right. But it turns out equal isn't what most women really wanted. Women long to be treated special, and they should be. Not equal, dare I say, even ladylike. Biblical masculinity doesn't dominate women. It elevates women. True male leadership treats women to a better quality of life. Well, here in verse 2, we're told, "In that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and appealing for those of Israel who have escaped." Notice here God makes three promises in the wake of his judgments. First, that the branch shall be glorious. The branch was a messianic term. Messiah was a branch from David's family tree. God promised King David a dynasty that would produce an everlasting ruler that would sit on an eternal throne. Jesus is that branch. Second, Isaiah promises restoration and prosperity from the ravages of war. That after the judgment, the fruit of the earth shall be excellent. And then third, he promises a remnant or a group of Jews that will escape the judgment and live to begin again. This prophecy came true in Isaiah's day, and it will also give hope to future Jews who endure and who come out of the Great Tribulation. The future Jews will endure a terrible time. They'll come out of that time, though, to live 1,000 years in the shade of a new ruler, the branch. Jesus will return to earth to sit on Israel's throne to restore God's people and to ensure their prosperity. Now, since Isaiah's prophecy sort of swings back and forth from his day to the last days, I thought it would be helpful to kind of give you a brief outline of the prophetic scenarios that end this current age. Today, God is growing his church. But when he's done, the church will be raptured, will be caught up together with the Lord. And God will again turn his attention, his focus to Israel. By various means, he'll preach the gospel to the ends of the earth. But as it's done for 2,000 years, Israel will refuse to trust Jesus as their Messiah or Christ. Thus, God allows the nation to be double-crossed by one Antichrist. This world leader will lead a global revolt against God, which God will topple with a flurry of cataclysmic chaos. You can read about it in Revelation chapter 6 through 8. It all culminates in a war where Jesus returns to put down the revolt and establish God's kingdom on the earth. Finally, Israel will embrace Jesus as their Messiah. And in the new world that emerges, Israel will prosper for 1,000 years while King Jesus rules the world in peace and in justice. That's some good news. Verse 3. "And it shall come to pass that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone who is recorded among the living in Jerusalem." Obviously, this follows a great devastation. "When the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the blood of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning." The book of Revelation zeroes in on a final 7-year period of fierce judgment from God. It's called the Great Tribulation, and it has two purposes. On the one hand, the world will be punished. This wicked world we live in needs to be punished. Judgment is due. The world will be punished, but on the other hand, Israel will be purified. The spirit of burning or purging or purifying will occur. It's interesting, this same events, this Great Tribulation, will affect both groups differently. The world will be punished, but Israel will be purified. "Then the Lord will create above every dwelling place on Mount Zion and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a covering." And this is such an amazing promise. The cloud by day and the fire by night will appear again. See, these two phenomena have always symbolized God's presence. In Genesis chapter 15, when God made his strategic covenant with Abraham, he appeared to Abraham how? As a smoking censer and as a burning torch. smoke and fire, the cloud and the fire. When God led Israel through the wilderness, he sent a cloud in the daytime and a pillar of fire by night. When the temple was established, fire fell on the sacrifice while a glory cloud hovered in the holy place, the cloud and the fire. Even in the New Testament, on the day of Pentecost, tongues of fire were seen over the heads of the disciples, and the Holy Spirit came as a cloud or as a mighty wind rushing in to fill his followers. Even today, God's Spirit acts in us like a fire and like a cloud. He burns away our sin, and he reveals the cloud of God's holiness and heaviness in our lives. Well, verse 6 tells us, and there will be a tabernacle, some kind of tent, for shade in the daytime from the heat, for a place of refuge, and for a shelter from storm and rain. Zechariah 14, verse 16 predicts that in the kingdom age, when Jesus reigns, the citizens of the world will come to Jerusalem to worship him. Apparently, provisions will be made for the crowds, shade from the sun, shelter from the storm. And why not? For isn't that what Jesus has been to us? Shade from the heat of the world's trials, shelter from the thunder of this world. It's fitting that he provides the same for all who worship him. Chapter 5 tells us, now let me sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. Here, Isaiah the prophet becomes a poet. He begins to sing a song. He dug it up and cleared out stones and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst and also made a wine press in it. So he expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes. You know, even today, vineyards dot Jerusalem's hillsides. In the Old Testament, the grapevine was a symbol for the nation. The temple doors were actually carved with different grapevines, golden vines. Why? Well, a vine is a symbol of joy. And this is what Israel was supposed to bring to God, great joy. This is why God plowed and planted and weeded and watered and spent so much time and effort cultivating his people Israel. He wanted to produce good grapes, but instead Israel yielded only wild grapes. Verse 3, and now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, please, between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done to my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why then, when I expected it to bring forth good grapes, did it bring forth wild grapes? The vineyard's failure was not God's fault. He had done all he possibly could. He had tended and cultivated and watered and weeded. The people had sinned and rebelled against God. And we need to ask ourselves, what is coming out of our lives, good grapes or wild grapes? God is doing his part. Are we doing ours? And now, please, let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it shall be burned, and break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned or dug, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice, but behold, oppression, for righteousness, but behold, a cry for help. It was because of Judah's sin that God removed his protection around the vineyard. The vineyard became vulnerable to break-ins and takeovers and weeds and drought. In short, there was a limit to God's perseverance. And what was true of Israel of old is also true of Christians today. Read John chapter 15, the parable of the vine and the branches. Jesus is the vine and we are the branches. And yet similar lessons are taught there as here. Jesus says in John 15, every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. It's true for us. Push God's patience, and there comes a time when he'll give us over to the decisions that we've made. He'll give up on turning our heart, and he'll give us up to the independent life that we've stubbornly pursued. Resist God to that point, and he'll remove his hedge. The rest of chapter 5 consists of six woes that are pronounced on Judah. Verse 8, woe to those who join house to house. They add field to field till there is no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land. Notice first, God condemns Jerusalem's overcrowding. You know, throughout the Bible, God likes gardens. Have you noticed that? God likes green spaces. In Isaiah's day, apparently the real estate developers were cramming too many houses in side by side. Oh, it increased the profits, but at the cost of healthy living conditions. Isaiah says, in my hearing, the Lord of hosts said, truly many houses shall be desolate, great and beautiful ones without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield one ephah. In other words, once fertile land will become barren. A 10-acre vineyard will produce a scant 9 gallons of grapes. Now here Isaiah uses several ancient measurements. This is probably not on your calculator, but these were the way the ancients measured things. A bath is equal to about 9 gallons. A homer is not something that Justin Upton hits, but a homer was like 11 bushels. So a bath is 9 gallons, a homer is 11 bushels, and ephah equals 1 bushel. Thus, Isaiah is saying it's going to take 11 bushels of seed to yield 1 bushel of grapes or veggies. This is what uncontrolled development does. It strips the land of its nutrients. Whereas God made the land to be fertile and to produce wonderful crops, it becomes barren because of our overworking it. I hope you notice from this verse that God cares about the environment. He does. Here God goes green. He is concerned about what we do to His creation. And when mankind harms the environment, it eventually brings harm to Himself. He says, woe to those who rise early in the morning, that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue until night, till wine inflames them. Now here's another woe. Woe to the party crowd. Hey, did you know that beer at breakfast is probably not a good idea? Start drinking first thing in the morning, and there's a problem, man. Here he talks about those that start drinking in the morning and they drink all through the day. Even in Isaiah's day, the people of Judah couldn't wait to wrap their hands around a big cold one. He says the harps and the strings, the tambourine and flute and wine are in their feasts, but they do not regard the work of the Lord nor consider the operation of His hands. Now, certainly the Bible teaches that drunkenness is a sin. But when I read verse 12, the real offense here seems to be leaving God out of the celebration. He says, they do not regard the work of the Lord. The world parties to forget about God. All our celebrations should focus on remembering Him and giving Him honor. Therefore, my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. Their honorable men are famished, and their multitude dried up with thirst. Remember, those were the ones drinking beer at breakfast. They eventually died of thirst. Therefore, Sheol, which is another name for hell, has enlarged itself and opened its mouth beyond measure. Their glory and their multitude and their pomp, and he who is jubilant shall descend into it. Notice they start out with an ice-cold beer in their hand, but they end up hungry, thirsty prisoners, ultimately inhabitants of hell. According to Isaiah, Judah's party train was headed for hard times on earth, but also some hot times in eternity. I hope you don't believe the common notion that hell is going to be one big party. You don't believe that, do you? I hope not. That everyone in hell will be raised in hell? You know, some people have that idea. You know, I'm going to go to hell and just party it up with my buddies. Don't count on it. That's not true. Sure, some folks are going to party all the way to hell. It says it here in verse 14. He who is jubilant shall descend into it. Some folks are going to party all the way to hell. But once they get there, they're going to discover that the refrigerator's empty. There are no cold ones in hell. In Luke chapter 16, the rich man, cried out to Abraham from hell. You remember what he said? Have mercy on me and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. And sadly, no mercy was given. Hey, don't expect a Coors Light Silver Bullet Express to run through hell, cooling everybody off. It won't happen. Realize drinking alcohol may be a matter of consciousness, but understand drunkenness is a sin. Do you know the only cells your body doesn't replenish are brain cells? Did you know that? The average person is born with 17 billion brain cells. And each time he or she consumes large amounts of alcohol, it kills off about 10,000 brain cells. Now, there's a lot of reasons I don't drink, but not the least of which is I need all the brain cells I can get. Take heed to Isaiah, and don't party your way to hell. Notice one more point in verse 14. I think it's interesting. Sheol, which was a Hebrew term for hell, is enlarged. It seems hell grows to fill the demand. And to me, this speaks volumes of the love of God. You remember in Matthew chapter 25, Jesus said that hell wasn't made for man, but for the devil and for his angels, or his demons. God sized up hell for just a few occupants. He never wanted men to go to hell. Hell wasn't made for man. It was made for the devil and his demons. Folks go to hell because they choose to by rejecting Jesus. But it was never God's intention. He loves us too much. It's interesting to me that hell has to be enlarged to meet the demand. Verse 15, people shall be brought down. Each man shall be humbled. And the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. But the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God who is holy shall be hallowed in righteousness. People are brought down, and God is lifted up or exalted. This is the goal of all God's judgments. This is what's needed today. People, as I see it, are riding on their high horse. People need to be brought down. God needs to be exalted. Ultimately, God's judgments will create just that scenario. J. Vernon McKee, he writes in his commentary, in the thinking of the world, God has been removed from the throne of judgment, divested of authority, robbed of his regal prerogative. He has been towed to the edge of the world and pushed over as excess baggage. He is characterized as a toothless old man with long whiskers, sitting on the edge of a fleecy cloud with a rainbow around his shoulders. He is simple, senile, and sentimental. He does not have enough courage or backbone to swat a fly or crush a grape. His place is in the corner by the fireplace where he can knit. This is the world's concept of God. But this is not the God of the Bible. It's not the God that we read about in Isaiah, a God of swift judgment. One day our God will surprise the naive. And yet the second woe ends in blessing. He says, then the lambs shall feed in their pasture, and in the waste places of the fat ones, strangers shall eat. When Jesus reigns, there'll be enough leftovers, even for the strangers to feast. Here's a third woe. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of vanity and sin as if with a cart rope. In other words, Judah was prideful. They thought they could sin and not be caught. They drew iniquity with cords of vanity. Verse 19 finishes quoting them. That say, let him make speed and hasten his work that we may see it. And let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come that we may know it. In other words, if God is going to judge us, let us see him do it now. They're baiting God. They're taunting God. From March the 10th to the 23rd, I'll be leading a tour to Israel. And we would love for any of our listeners to join us. We'll start at the magnificent theater on the Mediterranean where Paul preached to King Agrippa. And we'll end with worship and communion at the Garden Tomb. In between, it's one exciting adventure after another. Imagine relaxing by the Sea of Galilee one day and floating on the Dead Sea the next, exploring waterfalls in the Golan Heights and admiring the desert from the top of Masada. We'll spend time in the rock city of Petra and in the holy city of Jerusalem. We'll ride camels, wade through Hezekiah's tunnel, boat across the Sea of Galilee, and study God's Word at every turn. Hey, a trip to Israel is like a Bible study on steroids. If you've never been, I encourage you to go. And if you like, you can go with us. Our trip is affordably priced. If you'd like more details, please contact us. Here's Josh to give you that information.
Thanks, Pastor Sandy. Yes, to learn more about this exciting trip, visit sandyadams.org. Again, this amazing trip is taking place March 10th through the 23rd, 2019. We encourage you to contact the church office at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. You can call us at 770-736-2828 or log on to sandyadams.org. On behalf of Pastor Sandy and the entire production team, it's our prayer that you would seek the Lord about joining Pastor Sandy in Israel in March of 2019.